All right. Good afternoon, everybody. Let's call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It's Monday the 16th, about 1:32, 1:33. We have Senator Hughes and Senator Keel, Senator Coghill, Chair. We expect to see Senator Machiki coming in here shortly. We have, to remind us where we're at in the world, we have Nancy Hemingway and we have Carson Walters here to make sure that we are broadcast well, and Sean Ayers has kind of kept me going on how we're moving forward on this. Today we have three things in front of us, if we can get to them. We have Senate Bill 76, we'll get to Senate Bill 8, and we'll finish out some testimony on the constitutional SJR 13. And I'm hoping that we can get to that towards the end. And what I've told people is probably 2:30. We'll start the public testimony on that. But right now we have Senator Wilkowski and his staff, Nate Graham, who will come to us and present Senate Bill 76. Just to let the record reflect, Senator Machiki has joined us. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Chairman.
And what we're going to do, Senator, is we're going to have Senate Bill 76 come before us. This is our first hearing. I do have some invited testimony, but the intention is to give the Senator ample opportunity to explain the why and the how of Senate Bill 76. Senator, put yourself on the record.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Wilkowski. I'm a state senator representing East Anchorage and Jaybear. And it's good to be back before the Senate Judiciary Committee, where I had served for a number of years with you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Had some good times. Sometimes not so good. I filed this bill, Senate Bill 76, to repeal the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission. It would save the state over $425,000 per year. Just a real quick history on how the Workers' Compensation Board works, the current framework. If a worker is injured on the job in the state of Alaska, they file a workers' compensation claim. Fortunately, the number of claims that we have seen filed in recent years has been trending down significantly. In 2018, there were 17,694 reports of injury or occupational illness that were filed with workers' compensation, and that was a 3.8% decrease from 2017. And if you go back all the way to 2008, you would find the number was 23,000 cases filed as opposed to now 17,600. So it's down fairly significantly. That's good news. If there is a dispute, then that claim goes before the Alaska Workers' Compensation Board. And the board is composed of a hearing officer who's typically an attorney, works for the state of Alaska. And then there are two representatives, one from organized labor and one from management. And those members are picked by the governor, confirmed by the legislature. Under existing law, if there is an appeal from that workers' compensation board decision, then that would go under existing law to the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission. And just by point of reference, out of those 17,694 cases I mentioned, there were 231 hearings before the Workers' Compensation Board, which is actually down from 255 in 2017. Of those 231 workers' compensation cases, the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission in 2016 heard 10 of those cases. So 10 of those 231 decisions were appealed in 2016. There were 10 decisions in 2017. There were 14 in 2018, I believe 19 in 2019. So it's a very small number of cases that actually do end up going before the commission, which is part of the reason that we're seeking to repeal the commission. However, for those 10 to 14 to 19 cases, it costs $425,900 this fiscal year to pay for that. And it's our position that these appeals can be absorbed by the Superior Court. In fact, that is not a novel position. That's not a novel situation for decades. In fact, since statehood until 2005, the year that the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission was set up, that is exactly where they went. If a board issued a decision, someone was unhappy with it, it would go to the Superior Court. This would have it go back to the Superior Court. The current system where you have appeals from the Workers' Compensation Board to another agency within the executive branch is the only instance that we've been able to find in the entire executive branch where the final result is actually not appealable to the Superior Court. So this is a truly a very uncommon situation that the Appeals Commission currently fills. The argument for creating the commission back in 2005 was that the public would benefit from having a commission that had particular expertise in workers' compensation. However, the complexity of workers' compensation is really not more complex than, say, family law issues or mental health issues or other legal issues that the Superior Court deals with on a regular basis. And based on the numbers that we've seen, this purported expertise has really not shown itself, because what we've seen is that roughly 50% of the cases that go to the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission actually end up going before the Supreme Court. And of those 50%, roughly 50% are reversed. So it's a tremendous, very high reversal rating. When the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission was created in 2005, the testimony was that back then about 25% of the workers' compensation cases that went to the Superior Court were appealed to the Supreme Court. In recent years, we've seen, for example, in 2018, 79% of the cases were appealed from the commission to the Supreme Court. In 2017, 80% of the cases went from the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission to the Supreme Court. In 2016, that number was 50%. So you have more cases percentage-wise being appealed to the Supreme Court than under the previous system, with as I mentioned, roughly 50% of those cases being reversed. Another argument in favor of creating the commission in 2005 was that the cases would be decided quicker than they had been being decided in the Superior Court. However, we reviewed the minutes from 2005, and what we found was that the testimony back then was that a typical case would take anywhere from 8 months to 18 months before the Superior Court issued a decision. In 2018, the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission issued its annual report, which shows that the average case was taking a little over a year before a final decision was issued, which is actually over its target, and which is sort of in the middle between what it was taking the Superior Court to issue decisions back in 2005. So we don't have more timely decisions. This is not a new idea to repeal this commission, Mr. Chairman. In fact, it's an issue which has been afforded wide bipartisan support over the years. 5 years ago, this was recommended in the House. House actually passed that, a bill to eliminate the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission. And now it didn't go through the Senate all the way, but now I'm taking that issue up again. And I have a short slideshow I can go through, which will be very quick, Mr. Chairman, because I know we're pressed for time.
Please do that, and then we'll open it up to questions after that.
Thank you. Okay, so again, Senate Bill 76, it just simply repeals the Alaska Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission, returns jurisdiction to the Superior Court, saves $425,900, and it helps fill the workers' compensation budget deficit and make the Alaska workers' compensation system more solvent. I was asked to produce this graph at the last committee that we heard because there was a little bit of confusion, but essentially, if you follow this chart down, if an injured worker gets hurt, a worker gets hurt on the job, they go ahead and they file a workers' compensation claim. That would go before the Workers' Compensation Board if there was not a resolution. As I mentioned, the vast, vast majority get resolved, but out of 17,000 or so, about 231 do get heard before this board. Nothing there changes. This is where it would change. If a party appeals the decision under the current system, goes before the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission, which is composed of a Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission judge, and then there's a labor member and a management member. If either party is unhappy with that decision, then it would go before the Alaska Supreme Court. What this would do is it would change the appeals process to have it go to the Superior Court, which, as I mentioned, it had gone for roughly 40 years. If the party is still unhappy at the Superior Court level, they would have a right again to go to the Supreme Court. The commission has two full-time employees, pays commissioners travel per diem. The court system has submitted a zero fiscal note. So it would, the savings would be roughly $425,900 has been the estimates in recent years. This is a chart that shows the number of cases, and you have cases filed and then published decisions. There, in many years, you'll see a pretty wide disparity between those, and I think the fundamental reason is cases get appealed, and then the parties may continue to go through the settlement process, and one party may decide to settle, or both parties may ultimately decide to settle the case, which I think you see quite a bit of. But you can see when this first came out, you had an initial spike, and you had 40 to almost 50 cases getting filed, and then you've seen a downtrend. And the real thing to look at is the published decisions, because that's really the workload that's being done, and it's really dropped pretty significantly. It's been between 10 and 20 since 2010, and as the court system has testified, they can absorb that within their system at no additional cost. This was the narrative budget subcommittee report from the House several years ago, and it was Representative Tammy Wilson in 2015. This was the suggestion to eliminate this. This was, I think, the first legislative suggestion to do that, and they found was an ineffective division. They had closed 30 cases at a closure rate of 67% in 2013. They found the closure rate and average time for closure was not demonstrably better than the process was before the establishment of the commission, and that was in February 25th. And ultimately, that there was a bill that was proposed in 2017, which did pass unanimously, 40 to zip, Mr. Chairman, which is not something that happens a lot in the House these days. The Workers' Compensation Commission has not closed cases faster than the courts. As I mentioned previously, the Superior Court took anywhere from 8 to 18 months, according to testimony in 2005. It was estimated the commission would decide cases in 6 months. Instead, it's been more than double that. At about a little over 12 months.
Can you take a question now?
Absolutely.
Senator Machicki?
Thank you, Senator Wilikowski. And when you give an average, these aren't apples to apples. Do you have any idea what the average was for the Superior Court?
This was literally the direct testimony. We can produce the exact testimony that was given. It was by, I believe, Doug Wolliver at the time, who was from the court system. And that is the exact testimony that was given, was it took the court between 8 and 18 months. They didn't give an average at that time, to my knowledge.
Mr. Chairman, it's likely better than 12.2 months. That's kind of my point.
Oh, you're talking about the average?
Yeah.
Well, that's the average today, according to the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission, is that it averaged, the average today is 371 days to decide a case.
Still better than the Superior Court.
Well, if the Superior Court took 8 to 18 months and this takes 12 months, that's...
Yeah, you're averaging one 8 to 18, and you could do probably the same thing with the Appeals Commission.
Oh, if you went 12, yeah, I don't know what the average was. Yeah. That's all, and I just don't have those figures.
Yeah, that's what I think what he was disputing is that if you wanted apples to apples, one would be 8 to 18 months, one would be probably 6 to 12 months, something like that.
Fair point.
Still faster is what I'm saying. Senator Machicki, did that help you get to the
point? Yeah, I was just curious if you can get that. It's likely the Superior Court was probably more efficient than the Appeals Commission. That's kind of my bottom line. 8 to 18 months doesn't tell us a lot. But if you can get that would be helpful.
We'll pull up the exact testimony and find out what the number is, if we can.
I think probably the only person that has issue with the senator's bill is the chairman, and at this point, I'm trying to give it as honest a hearing as I can.
Sure.
I have been supportive of the Appeals Commission down through the years, to let you know, but I'm open to this discussion. Certainly saving money is a big part of it, but also helping workers is another part. And so as I'm listening, that's part of what I'm listening for. So thank you. Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you. Okay, so I guess another thing to consider on the time, and again, I don't have statistics on this, but what we heard again back in from Doug Wolliver, who was, we all know Doug, back in 2005, was that when the Superior Court handled the cases, approximately 25% of those decisions were appealed to the Supreme Court. Since the commission was created in 2005, roughly 45% total of those decisions have been appealed to the Supreme Court. However, since 2011, it's actually been 71% of those cases have been appealed to the Supreme Court. And so I think when you factor in the total amount of time, and I don't have this broken down, but when you go to the Supreme Court, you're adding on a year, probably 2 years additional time. So I think if you were to factor the time...
Wait, Senator, if I could just interject here. 71%, for example, you take it down to 10 cases that would go on. Do we know for sure that that's what the number of Superior Court cases would be, for example? And so I think just comparing one to the other, we just don't have those numbers because of the number of years that the commission's been in. But to me, the commission's been working because it's got it whittled down to the smaller, tougher cases that will get appealed to the Supreme Court. So that's just something that I've been thinking about along the way. So please continue.
Thank you. And I can actually get you a breakdown of the number per year of cases that are appealed to the Supreme Court. We have that information if you'd like, just in since the creation of the commission. This is the deficit that occurs in the workers' compensation to fund Alaska workers' compensation in Alaska in 2019. You can see it was $9.1 million, and they collected $8 million. The rest is made up by general fund. So this is helping to close that gap.
So just on that point, it seemed to me like the last time we were talking about this, that money really would not be saved, but it would just be turned over to the safety program. Do I understand that correctly?
So, yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The way the program works is there's a tax that's collected on workers' compensation policies, and then that helps to fund the system as a whole. If there's not enough money to fund that, then it's got to be made up somewhere, and that's the general fund. So if you have $425,000 that's additional, that's less. That helps close that gap, which means you have less general funds that you have to expend.
So, and you don't have to answer it now, but that was kind of the question that came up in my mind is, are we just trying to save money for the safety program rather than really an expedited or more efficient system? Or will we pay it through general fund one way or another? So that's, and I know the safety program is hurting for money. I get that. And so this is sending it over to Superior Court to save this money for that safety program. I understand that, but at the end of the day, I don't know that we're actually saving any money. That was my point. Get to.
Right. So in FY21, just to give an example, the projected cost is flat. It's been flat for the last couple of years at $9.1 million. However, you can see the income that's coming in is less, and that's because you have fewer cases, which is a good thing. But the problem is that you have a $2.5 million gap that you've got to make up. And so currently it's being made up with general fund dollars. If you take that out, if you lower the costs of the system by $426,000, you're lowering the amount of general fund dollars you got to pay. So,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Machicki has a question.
So if you're lowering it by 425 and your gap is less than 425, you're filling the gap of the cost to the workers' compensation tax. Actually, you'd have a surplus. Is that correct?
No, I think he said it the other way. Go ahead and give those numbers again, Senator.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You still have a deficit, but it'll be less of a deficit that would have to be made up because the cost of the overall program is $9.1 million and you're bringing in $6.4 million in 2021. So what you'd be doing, you'd be lowering that blue line because you'd be lowering the program costs. Because you got to make up that difference somehow. And currently it's general fund dollars.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Or you can raise, I suppose you could raise the taxes on employers. But. And just in summary, the bill would save $425,900. It would preserve the party's right to have their cases heard in a timely manner. We believe it would reduce the appeals to the Supreme Court and make the Alaska workers' compensation system more solvent. That's all. Thank you.
Questions? And We do have several people lined up for testimony. Do you want to just go ahead and take us real quickly through the sectional on this?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask my staff to do that.
Nate Graham, go ahead.
Thank you. For the record, Nate Graham, staff to Senator Bill Wilikowski. So I'll just go through this sectional real quick. Section 1 establishes that the Workers' Compensation Board will be the agency responsible for maintaining the records of the repealed Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission, and it also establishes that decisions the commission made will remain precedent unless they are overturned or modified by the courts. Section 2 removes a reference to the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission from a provision related to confidentiality of medical records. Section 3 and Section 4 are similar and just remove the mention of the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission. Section 5 is a new section that creates the procedures for appeals to the Superior Court. Subsection A states that the board decisions become effective when they are filed, and they can be modified or reconsidered and be appealed to the Superior Court. Subsection B states that board decisions are not automatically stayed, but the Superior Court can stay them if they would, if they need to. Subsection C states that factual findings by the board shall be considered conclusive upon their appeal. Subsection D allows the Division of Workers' Compensation to intervene in appeals and to file appeals if a party is not represented by attorney by an attorney and the case presents an unsettled question of law. Subsection 6 is conforming to reflect the changes made in subsection 5. Subsection 7 removes a reference of the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission from a list of commissions whose members must file financial disclosures. Section 8 repeals a court rule related to the commission. Section 9 repeals another reference to the commission. Section 10, this section is an indirect court rule amendment to reflect changes made by Section 5. Section 11 deals with the transition and phasing out of the commission and how the cases should be handled by the Superior Court. Subsection A states that the commission will continue to handle cases through December 1st, 2020. Subsection B establishes a new procedure in Section 5 of this bill that does not apply to cases before December 1st, 2020. Subsection C states that the old statutes will apply for appeals of final decision made by the commission issued by December 1st, 2020. Then Section 12 adds additional transitional provisions. Subsection A states that all new appeals of board decisions made after June 1st, 2020 will be filed with the Supreme Court. Subsection B states that appeals of commission rulings made before December 1st shall be filed with the Supreme Court. Subsection C ends the commission's ability to order reconsideration of cases on December 2nd, 2020, and all outstanding requests for reconsideration pending on that date would automatically be rejected, and any party whose request was denied may appeal their case to the Supreme Court. Subsection D requires the commission to transfer all of their files for all pending cases to the Superior Court on December 2nd, 2020, and to provide the parties 30-day notice of the transfer of jurisdiction if the court finds that the records do not meet the requirements of the rules of appellate procedure. It may order the commission to take necessary changes and resubmit them. Section 13 ends the terms of all commission members on December 31st, 2020. Section 14 makes the act only take effect if the court rule changes in Section 8 and Section 10 are adopted, and Section 15 provides for an effective date.
Questions for the sponsor at this point? Looks like it's...
I had a question just back on the presentation one more time, because something you said, Mr. Chairman, and something he said, I think we should settle it. This and is whether or not it actually saves us money. So the fact is right now the entire program cost $9.1 million. If we subtracted $425,000 out of it, it would cost $8.675, right?
Yes.
What you're saying is we're taking in an amount of tax at $6.4 million, so you actually do save $425,000 from the general fund that's today covering that gap.
Right.
It would not be spent for that. It would be that much less that's spent in general fund dollars. So it is actually a savings.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, through the chair. And and I could go back and get you the specifics of where that money is. I mean, basically the court has said anything that's not in an, in I mean, basically everything that's out there is part of the general fund. So there may be a separate account where that money is kept, but ultimately you are either keeping the system, and I'll get you the exact details of where that money comes from, but yes, you are saving $426,500, $900,000. I haven't seen a fiscal, that's my understanding of how it works, yes.
Yeah, and we have several people lined up for testimony, but I will maintain that if you have 230 some cases and you put them into the Superior Court, that time is still gonna be there. And so then the question is, what value do you get, the precedent you get, and are you going to get the same amount of appeals? And I think that's what you were presenting to us, that you would have reasonably same amount of time, and the appeals would be probably within the realm, and the only thing that is left behind is precedent going forward. And that would be based on how the Superior Court manages these issues. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My fundamental argument is that there are roughly 10 to 20 cases that go to the Appeals Commission every year. Those cases, historically, for virtually all of statehood, were handled by the Superior Court. They did a fine job. They did it in a reasonable amount of time at no additional cost to the state. When the state stood up this Appeals Commission, it actually cost millions of dollars at the time. Now it costs us $425,900 roughly going forward every year. And we're for 10 cases to 15 cases a year when the Superior Court can handle it at the same reasonable, I think a reasonable amount of time and a savings to the state. I think that's a reasonable cut to make.
Okay. What I'd like to do, if it's all right with the committee, is go ahead and go to public testimony unless there's other questions for them right now. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I got 6 people lined up, and I'll just name off who they are so that you can see, Senator. I got Martha Tanzik. I got Andy Hemingway, Eric Croft, Michael Budinski, and Laura Bonner. And so I'm going to just take them in the order in which they called in, if you wish. And I'll go to Martha Tanzik with Barlow and Anderson in Anchorage. Martha, go ahead and put yourself on the record and give us your testimony. And I'm going to try to keep it down to 2 or 3 minutes, if you can.
Absolutely. Good afternoon, Esteemed Senators. My name is Martha Tanzik. I'm an Anchorage attorney with the law firm of Barlow and Anderson. Thank you all very much for your time today during this stressful and uncertain period. I'm sure you all have many places you would like to be, including potentially self-quarantine. So. The majority of my practice is workers' compensation defense, and the issue of the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission is certainly a challenge for everyone, I believe, who's involved. Having been on the recipient end of some precedent-changing decisions lately from the commission, I'm under no illusion that this is a perfect system. I don't believe there is such thing as a perfect system. Yet I'm still here to speak in opposition to this bill. As you're by now well aware, there are a few major concerns with repealing the commission and returning the first layer of appeals to the Superior Court. Briefly, and from my perspective, those are subject matter complexity, lack of resources at the Superior Court, and failure to meet the intent of the Workers' Compensation Act. Workers' compensation is a nuanced and relatively complex area of the law. The statutes have been modified extensively by case law over time, and especially since the legislative changes in 2005 that created the commission. For appeals from the board level, it's incredibly important to have individuals who are familiar with the Work Comp Act and cases adjudicating the appeal. That familiarity ultimately reduces the likelihood of appeal to the Supreme Court and increases the likelihood of a consistent body of law. Without that precedential value of the commission, there's little incentive to accept a ruling of the Superior Court. It's easier to anticipate that a change to the Superior Court, however excellent the practicing judges are, would likely result in increased litigation costs and overall lack of predictability for the practitioners and for the employees and employers in the system. There's also no indication that any other court or hearing judge would be correct more often than the commission. There's certainly, I hear, the increased number of appeals, but that also has to do with the major shift in the law that occurred since 2005. So to follow one of the comments from earlier, it's a little like comparing apples and oranges when you look at things from before 2005 and after 2005 appeals as we were attempting to navigate this new set of laws on causation. The other comment there has to do with the length of time that cases are open before the commission is often caused not by the commission's ability to move them through, but by pro se litigants or parties asking for extremely long extension requests. For example, there's one case which is in process now, which the unrepresented employee has asked for almost a year-long extension request. So that skews the numbers in that respect. The second issue has to do with lack of resources at the Superior Court. You've heard testimony that the court would do its best to accommodate, but they too were stretched thin. This is even more so than in 2017 when the issue was first explored. Just last week, I set two trials at the Superior Court, and I can tell you that both judges were quite concerned about being called to cover criminal and China cases, which both have constitutional timeline issues and thus come first over civil litigation. One judge was already scheduling 4 months out, and the other had his calendar for January through March of 2021 completely booked full for civil cases. That kind of delay is not beneficial for injured workers seeking relief, nor for employers and insurers seeking resolution in a timely fashion. It's my understanding that there's also a significantly longer period of time for the Superior Court judges to issue or render a decision. I believe it to be 6 months, and the Appeals Commission has only 30 days. So in terms of efficiency of getting decisions from those adjudicative bodies, the commission is much faster for everyone. The only likely outcome is significant delay and backlog in the system, especially as comp cases get pushed down in favor of more important ones like the criminal trials. To that end, I think it's a bit of a fallacy to think that the cases can be incorporated into the court system without any additional need for funds for that body. They're already short-staffed and likely need more judges in order to accommodate this. Nothing in the repeal truly supports the intent of the Act, which is quick, efficient, fair, and predictable delivery of benefits at a reasonable cost. Appeals through the Superior Court are not going to be quick, efficient, or predictable, and it's likely to result in increased litigation costs. There has been, I understand, a compromise put forth that might solve many of these issues, that perhaps if a subject matter expert were designated through the Office of Administrative Hearings, one who could have presidential value, then that person might be able to hear issues in a timely fashion, provide decisions that would allow for all of the parties to establish predictable delivery benefits. I understand that that would cost a quarter to a third of the prior budget that might free up the remainder of the funds for the other purposes that have been mentioned here today. I respectfully urge the senators to leave the commission in place, but if that's not what's ultimately decided, then perhaps the Office of Administrative Hearings solution most closely tracks with the legislative intent. Thank you for your time.
Martha, thank you very much. You got me right at 4 minutes, so thank you. And I appreciate the testimony. We're going to go next. Juno, we have Andy Hemingway on the line. Andy, are you there? Can you hear us? Put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Andy Hemingway. I'm retired from state service. I was an administrative law judge with the Office of Administrative Hearings. Later, I was the chair of the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission, and I retired from that position in 2016. And I'm testifying on my own behalf today, just personally. There's been reference to several of the policy matters that the Senate should be thinking about. The importance of having precedent setting decisions out of the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission as compared with decisions from the Superior Court, which are not binding on anybody except the parties in that particular case. And I think that's a very important benefit to the Appeals Commission that would be lost if these cases go to the Superior Court. You've heard testimony in prior committees about the value of having the assistance for self-represented litigants in front of the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission. They're very used to dealing with those folks. They do. The commission staff does a great job of helping those folks through the system. And with due respect to the court system, I just don't think, given their burdens, that they're equipped to provide quite the same level of customer service for self-represented litigants in these kinds of cases. As far as the timeliness issue goes, I don't know if I believe I've reviewed Doug Williver's testimony from 2005, and my recollection is that basically he said, well, we don't really track those out, but overall administrative appeals, he was saying take 8 to 18 months. But I don't think he had any information on specific time frames for workers' comp cases. I do think it's certainly the case that the Superior Court has a lot of other issues that are going to take priority when it comes to scheduling their own matters. So there may be some benefit to keeping them in appeals commission in terms of timeliness, but I think that's pretty hard to quantify. What I'd like to talk to mainly is the effectiveness and efficiency of the appeals commission in terms of the dollars that are being spent. First of all, although the number that is put out there is $425,000, the actual cost of the commission, if you look at the actuals, is $323,000. There's an appropriation of $425,000, but only $323,000 is actually being used by the commission. And so it's a relatively small amount, obviously, in absolute dollars, but also just as a percentage of the funding for the workers' compensation and occupational safety budget overall. Out of $9 million, only $323,000 is being spent on that function. Senator Wilkowski referenced an appeal rate ranging up to 79 or 80%. I think that's a misconception. The appeals from published decisions of the appeals commission are much less. It's less than 50% in the last 5 years of the published decisions that are appealed. The total number of appeals includes all of the appeals from unpublished orders issued by the appeals commission, which might be attorney's fees, orders dismissing a case, routine orders for extensions of time, and that sort of thing typically aren't going to be appealed. But there are a number of other matters that can be the subject of an appeal to the Supreme Court. And the if you look only to the appeals from published decisions, which are the final decision in a case where the commission as a whole issues a written decision, it's less than 50% over the last 5 years have been appealed to the Supreme Court. And I also think the rate of reversal is much closer to 60% than 50%. The percentage of affirmance is much closer to 60% than 50%. Over the last 10 years, my calculation was there were 57% of their cases that went up to the Supreme Court were affirmed, and only 28% were reversed, and the remainder was
affirmed in part. I need to ask you to wrap up only because I've got three more to go and I'm kind of running out of time.
Okay. I'll leave it at that, except to just add, in terms of the what you get for that amount of money, the court system on its two appeals courts is spending $7 million as compared with $323,000. And if you look at it by the case comparison, 666 cases in the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, that's about $10,000 per case. And in the appeals commission, it comes out to about $13,000 per case. So these are not big differences in terms of the amount of money it takes the court system on appeal to process a case versus the appeals commission. And in terms of the number of decisions per year, published decisions by the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, if you go on a per-judge basis, it's 14 for the Court of Appeals, 18 for the Supreme Court, 18 published decisions per year for the Supreme Court, each justice, 14 for each judge on the Court of Appeals. And that's about the same as the 14 or 15 decisions that the Appeals Commission chair authors each year. So in terms of the overall dollar cost, I think it's quite a small amount. And I think that it's comparable in terms of their cost efficiency to what you get from the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals. And in view of the policy reasons that have been talked about, precedent, pro se, assistance and ensuring that we don't bog down the court system and that these matters get taken care of in a timely manner. I think the Appeals Commission is well worth the investment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. And I'm sorry I don't have time for a lot of questions on this. I'm kind of rushed through the testimony. We're going to go to Eric Croft in Anchorage at this point. Eric, put yourself on the record and give us your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And understanding your time pressure there, I sent in a letter with 3 points. I'll just try and hit the first and the third.
Thank you.
Very quickly. The first is that the commission hasn't provided the legal clarity that is promised. I cite two cases where the Supreme Court had to reach down essentially just because they couldn't figure out what the commission meant. But more importantly, the Adamson case, which I was part of, where the commission in two different rulings within a week used two completely different legal standards, one to reject and the other to grant a stay. And so we had to bring up to the Supreme Court these two cases where within the span of about a week, the commission had had contradicted itself in effect. And I would just say that you get that a fair amount. It doesn't provide clarity, and we have to go all the way to the Supreme Court. So that hasn't come true. But more importantly, I can sense, Mr. Chairman, your defense of or affection for this commission. It really can be kind of COMP is a no-fault system. We don't have to fault the commission to say you're just not getting the caseload that would justify this continued expenditure. 10 to 20, and usually more like 10 cases a year decided, we thought it was, but it turns out not to be worth this level of expenditure. And I listed at the end of, in the package that I sent, I list all the decisions, the numbers of decisions over the years, and then the last two quarters for the Criminal Court of Appeals. And my numbers are that, it does about 14 cases a year, and that's what Mr. Hemingway testified to. The commission just does only about 14 or a little, kind of one a month, which is a pretty slow rate versus Criminal Court of Appeals, which had about 110 in half a year or about 220 for last year. It just is not. You can say it was worth a try, but it in the long run doesn't have the caseload that justifies this expenditure, and it's an easy way for us to save money. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Eric, thank you for taking your time to come before us, and thank you for the well-written testimony that you sent in, and I would encourage anybody to go ahead and send in written testimony. We get to be quite often the policymakers that get to stand between two very strong different opinions, and so we'll consider all opinions. At this point, I'm going to go to, is it Michael Badinsky? Did I say the name right, Michael?
Yes. Can you hear me, Mr. Chairman?
Yes. I got to get turned up. Say it again.
You hear me now, Mr. Chairman?
Very well. Thank you, Michael.
Okay. My name is Michael Badzinski. I'm an attorney with a law firm of Meschke, Paddock, and Badzinski in Anchorage. I am a practitioner in the area of workers' compensation and have represented employers in that system for about 36 years. So I have seen a lot of changes over the decades in my experience in workers' compensation matters. I have to agree with all of the comments by Ms. Tanzik as to why the Appeals Commission is a valuable appellate body, but I won't repeat those. I'm going to focus on something perhaps a little different, and that is that you have to realize the Appeals Commission has the most experience of any appellate body in the workers' compensation system, as currently constituted, for example, with its current chairperson and the board members. They have about 60 to 80 years combined experience in workers' compensation matters that they're bringing to these appeals. Superior Court judges have none. I looked at the list of Superior Court judges just to refresh myself, and none of them have been practitioners in the area of workers' compensation in the past, so they have no practical experience to bring to the appeals that they may hear. I think it's very valuable for the commission to have that experience. And even if the Superior Court, the Supreme Court, may disagree with what the Commission does, the Commission offers very logical and rational decisions that are well-reasoned, and they're based on the law. The Supreme Court itself, if we're looking at reversal rates, for example, the Supreme Court has its own agenda, so to speak, its own policy agenda that it is going to enforce no matter who hears the appeals. But it's valuable for the Supreme Court to hear and to see the rationale that the Appeals Commission offers in its decisions. No Superior Court judge is going to be qualified to do that. We know, even going before the Supreme Court, that they have large gaps in their knowledge about the workers' compensation system. We also know, from my own personal experience, arguing before Superior Court judges, that because of their lack of experience, everything to them is new. And so you have to literally, from the ground up, explain the workers' compensation system in general before you can get to the merits of the case. And it's just, there's very much a deer in the headlights kind of feeling when you're arguing before a Superior Court judge compared to the Appeals Commission, who, when you use legal terms, they know exactly what you're talking about. There's no confusion in that regard, and the Appeals Commission is much more efficient in that regard. It's also valuable for the Commission to have a three-member panel to discuss matters between them to come to the best decision. The Superior Court judge doesn't have that benefit, and in fact, there's no other judge they can go to get that kind of feedback, because no other judge either has that kind of experience in workers' compensation matters. So I cannot speak to the fiscal aspect of your decision about the Appeals Commission and whether it's worthwhile. You know that much better than we do. But in terms of the quality of the system, it does not make sense to me to substitute a panel that has 60 to 80 years of experience with a judge who has none hearing those appeals. So I would just urge the legislature to consider the quality of the process and not just the cost of the process.
Michael, I do have a question from Senator Keel. Can you take a question real quick?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Budzinski, did I understand you to say that the Alaska Supreme Court has an agenda regardless of the hearing on workers' comp issues? And if so, could you help me understand what that is?
They have the Supreme Court views itself as inserting a policy aspect to decisions, in my experience with the Supreme Court. Some of the cases do present to them matters of policy that have to be decided when interpreting the law. In my experience, the Appeals Commission looks much more closely to the law itself to apply the rules that it perceives to be there. The Supreme Court, in my experience, is much more open through its decisions, effectively changing the law. And so they're much more open to and likely to base a decision on what I would call policy considerations compared to the Appeals Commission. That's why sometimes you get a number of reversals, because the Appeals Commission will follow the letter of the law. The Supreme Court will say they don't necessarily agree with that, and they will base their decisions in part upon policy considerations.
I've had my own issues with the Supreme Court on that very topic, but at this point, I don't want to dig into that any further. I want to go ahead and get one last testifier, give the sponsor a chance to talk to us about some of the testimony. We're going to go to Laura Bonner, who's in Anchorage. Laura, put yourself on the record, and thank you, Michael, for being online. And Laura, you're up. Put yourself on the record, please.
Good afternoon, the Senate Judicial Committee members. My name is Laura Bonner, and I'm retired and live in Senator Rebeck's district. In the 1980s, my husband was injured on the job with permanent partial disability, so I'm familiar with the workers' comp and the processes involved, and I've watched how they evolved over the years. I support Senate Bill 76. According to a document I saw on BASIS, excuse me, the Workers' Appeals Commission was found to be, quote, an ineffective division. Any division by the Appeals Commission may end up in court anyway. And according to the fiscal note, it would save the state, well, it would not be expended for this commission and could be spent elsewhere, which is really important, especially now in our budget problems that we're having. So I hope you move Senate Bill 76 out of committee with the due pass and support it on the Senate floor. Thank you for hearing this bill and for allowing me the opportunity to speak.
Laura, thank you for coming before the committee and getting some pretty good backup with your dog. That was kind of nice, but we heard you very clearly. So anyway, thank you for taking your time to come before us. That did round out the public testimony that I wanted to have before the committee. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public testimony at this point. But I wanted to give the senator an opportunity to give us his final comments as we hear this bill. I intend to set it aside, but I'm open to discussion on how we move forward, Senator.
So yeah, please. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could respond to some of the points that were made. So there was a statement made that this actually cost $323,000 as opposed to $425,900. I'd suggest that for 10 cases a year, 14 cases a year, it's still worth saving $323,000. That's not what the state said. That's not what the Department of Labor said in the fiscal note that they provided us. Maybe Mr. Hemenway knows something that the Department of Labor doesn't, but the fiscal note that they provided us says it would provide a savings of $425,900 per year. That's OMB component number 2816, dated 1/24/20. As far as subject matter complexity, there's this thought that this is such a complex area. This is no more complex than family law. This is no more complex than criminal law. This is no more complex than trust law, Mr. Chairman. And I know you've handled many complex trust issues, which are, quite frankly, way more complicated than workers' compensation. This is no more complex than any of those. And quite frankly, it's a little bit of an insult to say that the Superior Court can't handle those. As far as the likelihood of appeals go, I provided you with this document. You all have it. In 2011, according to legislative research, there were 13 published decisions. Every single one of those was appealed to the Supreme Court. In 2012, there were 16 published decisions. 15 of those 16 were appealed to the Supreme Court. In 2013, there were 17 and 11 were appealed. In 2014, there were 15 and 12 were appealed. This is in the last probably 7 or 8 or 9 years, 71% of the cases are appealed to the Supreme Court. Now, when people come and say, well, this is providing stability and consistency and predictability, when you have 71% of the cases getting appealed to the Supreme Court, Mr. Chairman, I would suggest that's not providing a whole lot of stability to the system. That's not providing a whole lot of predictability to the system. That's not providing a whole lot of timeliness and quick efficiency to the system, because you have when cases go to the Supreme Court, you're extended out for another year, maybe 2 years, sometimes even longer. We heard a suggestion that, well, the Superior Court isn't capable of handling these pro se. The Superior Court handles pro se all the time. They handle thousands of pro se cases. I'm sure they would prefer not to. Quite frankly, if you look at the appeals that go to the Appeals Commission right now, based on my understanding, the vast majority are represented. There are certainly some that are pro se. The vast majority are represented. The Superior Court handles pro se cases all the time. They can handle them. The Supreme Court handles pro se cases all the time. They can continue to handle those. In terms of this is going to save on litigation costs, you're not saving on litigation costs when you have a system where 71% of the cases in recent years are getting appealed to the Supreme Court. That's adding time. And if you think it's expensive to have these cases, litigation costs are expensive. Tack on the cost to go to the Supreme Court. It is very, very expensive, Mr. Chairman. In terms of, let's see, there was a statement made, well, don't look at the published decisions, look at the unpublished orders. I don't even know how to respond to that, Mr. Chairman. These are motions for extensions. These are motions for attorney's fees. These are motions for settlement. You don't look at those when you're looking at overall appeal rate. If you were to add those on to what the typical Superior Court does, there'd be hundreds probably every month in terms of motions for extensions and attorney's fees and things like that. You don't look at those things. What you do look at is, according to Legislative Research Department, there were 253 published decisions from 2005 to 2018. 115 were appealed to the Supreme Court. That's That's almost 50%, a little bit slightly less. It is true. Slightly less than 50%. A huge percentage is reversed. There was some testimony, well, maybe it's only 43% are reversed. That's an enormous reversal rate, Mr. Chairman, for an appeals commission, which is supposedly stood up to provide some level of consistency and stability and predictability. That there's no predictability when you have 43% being reversed. In terms of this, there was a statement which I can't help but chuckle at. That is that this has 60 years of training and experience. This is basically the appeals commission is functioning as an appellate court, and yet two out of the three members have zero legal training. These are great people. I know them all, Mr. Chairman. I used to be a workers' compensation hearing officer. I've served with every single one of these people. They're really good people. Unfortunately, this is an appeals commission, which is set up in a way so that it is legal issues which they're determining. And you have two out of the three members on the appeals commission who have zero legal training. They're not attorneys. They're really good people. Don't get me wrong. In some ways, it's set up for failure because you have two out of the three people on every single case who have no legal training whatsoever. Every single 100% of the Superior Court will have legal training, and they can very quickly pick up these decisions, Mr. Chairman. And that's quite frankly probably why you have a reversal rate of 50% roughly. So I think when you look and there's a bit of an elephant in the room, which I'm going to mention, which was brought out in Eric Croft's presentation, which is this is a commission, quite frankly, which rules overwhelmingly for insurance companies. Overwhelmingly. In fact, Eric Croft, in his letter that he sent, documented that. And you can go through, and we can talk about that at length if you want, but this is a commission that routinely, overwhelmingly finds in favor of insurance companies at the expense of injured workers. That's the elephant in the room that, quite frankly, nobody wants to get into, but those are the raw facts of this issue. So you've got an appeals commission that isn't saving us money, that isn't saving us time, that isn't being quick and efficient, that isn't providing any more expertise to this, that isn't providing a quick and efficient remedy, and quite frankly, that has leaned in favor of insurance companies. I don't see any good reason why we'd keep this, particularly when we can save $425,900 every year. It's not going to save the world, but it's $425,000 here and there, and pretty soon you're talking serious money, Mr. Chairman. I would urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wilkowski, and thank you, Mr. Graham, for bringing this before the committee. I wanted us to get the best foot forward on this particular bill. I've already stated my reluctance on the bill, but I can tell you it's a compelling case and worthy of consideration. So with that, I'm going to set the Senate bill aside. We'll set Senate Bill 76 aside, but my intention is to take it up as we move along through here. Senator Wilkowski, thank you very much for taking your time to come before the committee. And it took a little longer than I thought, but I thought we needed to take the time. So we're going to go to Senate Bill 8 at this point. We have a version I'd like to adopt. But before we get there, I've got 18 people who signed up for Senate Joint Resolution number 13. And I need to warn them that I probably will only have the last 15 minutes. So if you have a time issue and you want to get a public testimony in, I would suggest you send it to the Judiciary Committee at, I think it's JUD at akleg.gov, I think. And and the intention is to not close public testimony at this point, for what it's worth. But for those 18 people online, I sure here's my testimony. I came before the legislature to testify on a bill. I took time off from work. I couldn't get into public testimony, and it cost me about $150 of my wages. And I am so sorry that the time of public testimony has just been very difficult to manage. But at this point, I need to get Senate Bill 3 up, which also has that same very issue on time management. And so I will get this dispatched as quickly as I can, get some public testimony. But my guess is we're only going to be able to get 15 or 12 minutes of public testimony in SJR 13. With that, what I want to do is switch over to Senate Bill 8, and we have a draft version that I would like to bring before us. And so with that, Mr. Vice Chair, could you make a motion to bring the version S of the CS for Senate Bill number 8 before us as a working document?
Mr. Chairman, I move CS for Senate Bill number 8, Judiciary, in front of the committee 31-LS0208/S as our working document.
And I'll object for this, and then we can speak to the issues that are before us in this explanation of changes. And an unusual methodology, because these were kind of brought to us by discussions from the committee and the sponsor. I'll have the sponsor go through these explanation of changes, if you don't mind. And at this point, what I'll do is have Alex Jorgensen probably, unless, Senator, you wanted to speak to him first.
Tom Baggett, State Senator for District J, Anchorage. No, I will let Alex walk through my state, my staff assistant walk through the changes, and then I'll be available for questions to the bill as a whole. But all these are changes that we've agreed to. And that
let's go down through the changes of this bill, and then we have Casey Schroeder, Lisa Puritan, and Lacey Wilcox online, who we have Casey from the Department of Law. Public Safety is Lisa Puritan, and then Lacey Wilcox with the Marijuana Industry Association. So, Alex.
Perfect. Yeah, so for the record, Alex Jorgensen, intern for Senator Baggage. So just jumping right into the explanation of changes from version A to version S. So the first change, page 1, lines 1 through 2, removes reference to Rule 37.6, Alaska Rules of Administration, in the title. This is to conform to the removal of Section 4 from version A, which was the indirect court rule change. Change number 2, page 1, line 9. Before, quote, criminal history background, delete the word A and insert certain types of. Change number 3, page 1, lines 9 through 10.
Brief at ease, I think.
Can I have a brief at ease? Do we have... All right, we'll come back on the record. Everybody's got the paper in front of them. Please, Alex, continue.
Again, for the record, Alex Jorgensen, intern for the office of Senator Baggage. I think, believe we were on change number 3, which is page 1, lines 9 through 10. Delete, quote, make it more likely, and insert increase the likelihood. Change number 4, page 1, line 10. Delete, quote, only, and insert, quote, those. Change number 5, which adds in a new section that will amend Alaska Statute 12.62.160, subsection B, subsection 8, which is relating to the release and use of criminal justice information. This new section of the bill is conforming language to include changes made to new background check policies that are changed in Senate Bill 8, or the committee substitute for Senate Bill 8. Change number 6, on page 1, line 12, delete, quote, notwithstanding B8 of this section, an agency may not release records of a criminal case, and insert, quote, an agency may not release criminal history record information. Change number 7, page 2, line 3, insert new subclause that reads, 2 was 21 years of age or older at the time of commission of the offense, and renumber the subclauses accordingly. Change number 8, page 2, line 3, add the word criminal before the word changes.
Charges.
Change number 9, page 2, lines 6 through 12, delete all the material and insert the section that is in the document, which reads Section 22.35.040
records concerning criminal cases for marijuana possession, the Alaska court system may not publish on a publicly available internet website the court records of a criminal case in which the defendant, one, was convicted under Alaska Statute 11.71.060 or a municipal ordinance with similar elements for possession of less than 1 ounce of a Schedule 6A controlled substance. Two, was 21 years of age or older at the time of the commission of the offense. And three, was not convicted of any other criminal charges in that case. Change number 10, page 2, line 13 through 23, delete both of those sections. And then finally, the last change on page 2, line 24, change the effective date to January 1st, 2021. And that's all the changes from version A to version S.
Any further objection? Then I'll remove my objection. We'll have this document before us. Senator Machicki?
I'm not sure that the page numbers are correct in the
Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
This is Senator Tom Baggage for the record, through the chair to Senator Machicki. These are referring to the pages that were in version A,
right,
and that consequently has now made the bill a three-page bill. So if you were following along, it would have been looking at A and seeing the change, which would then be shown in what is the S version of the bill. So, for example, the last of the suggestions, which was the effective date, is actually in version S. That would be shown on page 3, line 18. Likewise, the changes that are in the right before that page 2, line 13 through 23, of course, that material would no longer appear in the bill because it's been removed.
And my apologies, Senator, I should have explained that as we were going through that it would have been better to this was version A to S, and they were explaining the line numbers in version A, and I should have made that more clear. Sorry. With that, what I'm going to do is give you an opportunity to give us any other high-level comments before I set this bill aside, and we'll bring it back. I know that there is maybe some proposed amendments, but we needed to look at this language before we really got more seriously about that. And I know Senator Machicki was thinking that he'd like to add something in it, and I just wanted him to see this clean version before we got that far. Senator?
Thank you.
Senator Baggage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Tom Baggage, for the record. A couple things that I just say to remind you of why we moved from a version A to a version S. The first thing that I would say is that virtually all of these were just making sure that the language in the document was in a usage that was both compatible with our legislative legal drafting, and the Departments of Public Safety, right, and the Department and the court system. So we were made sure that the language was in language that was consistent with theirs. A number of these pieces of all these changes are around conforming language. The addition of the 21 years of age or older is because, of course, we had to comport to actual law. It's still a crime to consume marijuana under the age of 21, so you didn't want to get locked into a place where you were absolving somebody of something that would still be a crime today. It reminds us that no other criminal charges can be a party to the case. Just reminds us of that, changes the effective date because, of course, time goes by in these processes, Mr. Chairman. And finally, the court system has been clear with us that we don't need a rule change. And so we felt to remove the extraneous information was important. Take it out. So the reason the bill appears longer, even though we've taken sections out, is we actually amended a section of law which caused us to have to bring in that whole statute of existing language as we do when we amend a statute. But the only change is a single line, but it added a page to the bill. So.
Thank you. And I did have the Department of Law and Department of Public Safety here for questions, but Lacey Wilcox actually signed up to testify. And maybe I can get her to take just a couple of minutes and testify, and then I'm going to go lay the bill aside as we get to consider this new language in front of us. Lacey, can you hear us? Put yourself on the record and any testimony you want to give at this point.
Thank you, Chairman Coghill. My name is Lacey Wilcox. president of the Alaska Marijuana Industry Association, which is a trade group for licensed marijuana establishments statewide. And we've sent this in writing. I just noticed it wasn't online, so I wanted to call in and just go ahead and read real quick our support that will be coming in the packet. Okay?
How long would it take?
Oh, it's real short.
All right. Please do then.
Okay. So the Alaska Marijuana Industry Association is pleased to state its support for SB 8. We are fully supportive of the language you have put forward and the language you have in the CS. Under SB 8, Alaskans with prior convictions for conduct that would be legal today will have a better chance of securing housing, employment, and educational opportunities. And the AMIA, which we're known by, understands that this bill only makes these offenses confidential and does not technically expunge or provide an avenue to expunge. And we firmly believe this is a step in the right direction. And that's it. That's all I got. I would welcome any questions, and thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for being brief, and my apologies. So we're trying to just put as much into a committee as we can, and I wanted to get this bill before us. Senator Hughes?
And I hate to take up time because I know that there are people waiting online regarding, but I need a question answered just as we move forward and set this aside in the event we bring it back up. Because I realize that marijuana is legal now for those over age 21, and that is the law. My problem is if I'm an employer, I want to know someone who might have a tendency not to follow the law in any regard. So I guess to the sponsor, my question would be, I don't have a whole lot of heartburn about it being off of court view, but if an employer needed to know whether you know someone was a law-abiding citizen, would they be able to find this? If it's not being expunged, would they be able to get the information somehow if they wanted to make sure that their the candidate has a clean record? And I just want to say I want the people that have this in the past, I want them to be able to get housing, I want them to be able to get work, but I am concerned that in certain positions it might be very important to an employer to know that the person they're hiring does not have a tendency to break the law, and at the time they were breaking the law.
Senator Begich.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair to Senator Hughes, there's a number of things in the bill that are designed to protect those that would be potentially applying for positions of public safety and for positions that would otherwise place them, you know, the better way to answer that is there are some restrictions and there are some areas where you could get access to the information. What I'd like to do is have the Department of Public Safety reply to that so that I don't mess up or somehow convolute their presentation.
Let's do this. I'm going to just hold that off and ask you to do some research on that. I intend to bring this bill back before us on Friday, and then we'll consider it from there. Senator, thank you for taking the time to write this and to get it before us. I intend to have the court system come before us probably on Friday to kind of give them a heads up. My intention is to either take amendments and or try to move the bill from committee at this point on Friday. And thank you.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to lay the bill aside, Senate Bill 8 aside, and we're going to go right on to public testimony. This is concerning Senate Joint Resolution 13, which deals with a constitutional amendment with regard to abortion. So and my apologies to everybody online. As you can see, we're trying to fix up a lot of the issues for preparation for the rest of the body to consider. But at this point, I'm going to go to Wendy Perkins, who's in Anchorage, who's been waiting a good long time. And Wendy, thank you for your patience and all of you for your patience. Please put yourself on the record. Try to keep it as close to 2 minutes as you can. Thank you. Wendy, are you online? Are you on mute? Well, if Wendy, if you can hear us, try to reconnect. We're going to go to Karen Lewis, who's in Mat-Su. Karen, can you hear us?
Yes, hello. Thank you, Chairman Coghill and Senate Judiciary Committee members for giving us this opportunity to express our thoughts on this most important issue of protecting human life. SJR 13 is a good and needed amendment. Our forefather Thomas Jefferson stated in 1809 that the care of human life and happiness and not their destruction is the first and only legitimate object of good government. I think that was very well said. And in Congress, July 4, 1776, in the Declaration of Independence, a whole crew of people said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it." Very well said, too. And God has told us in his word that he hates the shedding of innocent blood. It's an abomination to him. He also commanded that thou shalt not murder. My daughter was born and raised in Palmer. She decided to attend Mankato State University in Minnesota. That's where my mother went to. She had been dating a young man, but decided he was a bit unstable, so she broke it off with him. However, she found out after that that she was pregnant. She told me years later that she had contemplated abortion for about a half a second, but knew she couldn't destroy the baby's life because it would be inconvenient and more difficult for her to proceed with her plans if she had a baby. But that's exactly what she did. She gave birth to Ethan, who is now 13 and one of the great loves of her life. Then she enrolled at Mankato State, and she graduated. But while she was there, she met Jesse, too, who was another student, and she married him and gave birth to two more children before graduating. So women out there, don't you believe that lie that you can't have a baby and go to college, too, because you certainly can. That's all. And, yes on this amendment, absolutely.
Karen, thanks for taking the time, and thank you for your patience and for everybody who's online patient. I'm going to go up to Anchorage at this point. Kathy Law, are you online, and can you give us your testimony?
Yes, I'm online.
Please put yourself on record and give us your testimony. Try to keep it in 2 minutes if you can, please.
Yes. I'm just calling to ask for your support of SJR 13, adding the language to protect human life to the Alaska State Constitution. It reads, "To protect human life, nothing in this Constitution may be construed to secure or protect a right to an abortion or require the state to fund an abortion." The resolution will make it clear that there is no right to abortion in the state constitution. Allow Alaskans through the initiative process to establish laws on the abortion to reflect Alaskans' values as a whole. The Alaska Constitution has never defined the right to abortion, but a series of state Supreme Court decisions invented the right. The word abortion isn't found in the state constitution. It was illegal in Alaska from the time that the constitution was drafted until the state court claimed that it was a constitutional right. We have the most extreme abortion policy of any state, regulating and protecting minors by requiring a preferential notification has been routinely struck down by our Supreme Court, which is very sad. I urge our state Senate to add the language of SJR 13 to Alaska's state constitution. Thank you for letting me speak.
Kathy, thank you very much for taking your time to testify. I'm going to go up to Fairbanks at this point to Serene O'Hara Jolly. Serene, can you hear us and put yourself on the line, a testimony if you can?
Hello and good afternoon. My name is Serene Rose O'Hara Jolly, and I'm in Senator Coghill's district in Fairbanks on the unceded lands of the Lower Kanaana Dene people, and I am representing myself. I strongly oppose SJR 13. Individual rights and freedoms go to the heart of who we are as a state, including the right to access safe and legal abortion. I find it unfortunate that some of the same senators that sponsored this bill believe the government should not have a role in paying for things like schools, ferries, or education, should not regulate the industries that extract from our land, but believe the one place the government should be, the one place that it should have a hand in regulation, is in telling people who can get pregnant what they can do with their bodies. This kind of hypocrisy brings the government's body suspect to many independents, Republicans, and Democrats in this state. Access to care, although made into a partisan issue, is not one for the people. An overwhelming majority of people living in Alaska support the right to access an abortion. Self-determination over our own bodies and destinies is a unifying factor amongst the many different communities that live here. Whether you recognize this bill for what it is, control over people who can get pregnant and those that love and care for them, or you believe it is a moral issue and your religious duty, either way, it's unacceptable. The elected officials have no right to tell the people in Alaska that they can choose their path. Each and every one of us has the right to choose our own. Amending the constitutional right to privacy in a state that prides itself on a narrative of individualism is unacceptable. Each of you took an oath of office to uphold the Alaska State Constitution, not to amend it to fit your moral values or change it to assert your power over the lives of others. I urge you to vote no on SJR 13. Thank you.
Serena, thank you for taking the time to come before the committee. We really appreciate it. And we're going to go to Sutton, Marcy Hawkins. Marcy, are you online? Can you hear us? Put yourself
yes,
on.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much. My name is Marcy Hawkins. I live in Sutton, Alaska, and I oppose this proposed amendment. I noticed that in the last testimony you had emphasized that this had nothing to do with preventing abortion or abortion funding. However, the title alone suggests that this amendment is for prohibiting abortion. And you also have several bills that are waiting for this amendment to go through in order to criminalize abortion. I don't understand why people have to be so interested in what happens with my body or a woman's body. And not that I'm going to disparage Thomas Jefferson, but wasn't this the guy that had slaves and enslaved? Also, right for women to vote did not occur until much later, so it was only men that could vote. So tell me right now, what is it that, you know, makes it impossible for a woman to be not be able to, you know, make medical decisions for her own body? This is the start of a slippery slope downhill that is going to cause a lot of grief, a lot of problems. We need to concentrate on what is here and now. We have children now that need our help, not what may be. So please don't rubber stamp this. Please do not vote this through. Thank you.
Thank you very much for taking the time to come before us. We really appreciate it. And for the patience of everybody here, we're going to go back up and see if Wendy Perkins in Anchorage is available to come online. Wendy, can you hear us?
Yes, thank you so much for taking my call and letting me get back in the queue. This is Wendy Perkins from Anchorage, Alaska, and this is to the chair and committee. I am just very strongly in support of SJR 13, and I just want to go back to the main point of this bill, because I know it's a very emotional thing for a lot of people, but the point is taking when the judicial branch is just allowed to take our Constitution or really anything and just go willy-nilly off on using a word like privacy that was intended for a very specific cause and turning it around and saying, oh, this is for abortion, is really, really dangerous. And I just think we need to be logical and rational about this. I mean, any of us, we all have opinions about, you know, politics, et cetera, but it's really dangerous when we just allow any branch of the government to go willy-nilly on our Constitution and make it say whatever they want it to say. So, yes, I'm very strongly pro-life. I hope that abortion is completely eradicated. The killing of the most innocent among us is horrible. But like, let's just stick to the facts, and the point of this is really, I think we can all agree that we don't want one branch of government being too strong, and the people need to let it open up to the people to decide rather than just a judge. Thank you so much.
Wendy, thank you. And I'm sorry we couldn't get to you earlier, but thank you for sticking it out. And giving your testimony. We're going to go to Palmer at this point. Cheryl Kajdan, did I get that right?
Hi, my name is Cheryl Kajdan. I'm testifying on behalf of myself, and I really want to thank you for listening to me today. You know, we fight so hard for life, and what we're doing with coronavirus really shows that. And as a nation, we have fought for the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And we know without life, I mean, nothing else matters. I mean, if you don't have life. Many advocating abortion say they do so out of concern for the mother, you know, my body. Well, as a biologist, I know that the chromosomal components are different between child and mother. And I know that when abortion, because I was there in 73, became legal, they wanted abortion to be legal, safe, and for every child to be wanted. And that I feel that the changes in our moral stance have degraded our general civil behavior. Dr. Mildred Jefferson is the first African-American graduate of Harvard Medical School. She's the co-founder of a national right to life, and she warned Americans that abortion would be used to target the African-American community. She also warned that abortion access to poor women would be used to justify keeping abortion legal, and data proves her correct. More than half of African-American babies are killed yearly in New York City by abortion. African-American women have the highest rate of abortion of any ethnic group, with a majority of Planned Parenthood offices being located in minority neighborhoods. 2014 Michigan statistics report that for every 1,000 live births, 391 African-American babies have been aborted. Where African-Americans make up 12% of the population, their babies comprise 35% of the abortions performed. Abortion should give us pause as a state, which has a significant proportion of minority populations. Other states have been able to put limits or conditions on abortions legislatively, and that has not been possible in Alaska. Our representation and the voice of our people has been blocked by men and women in black robes, the Alaska Supreme Court. Please vote in support of SJR 13 and allow the Alaskan electorate to have a voice in this very controversial topic of abortion funding and other procedure parameters. And I just have to speak in favor of life. I believe life is divine, and no person has a right to kill another life. Belgium, Netherlands, other country, they're now killing children age 12.
Thank you, Cheryl. I'm sorry I have to do this to you, but I appreciate everybody who has come to give their testimony, and certainly, Cheryl, I hate to cut you off, but we have several people who have been left online and still have a lot of passion in this discussion. Please be aware that I will keep the testimony open. This is a tough issue for all of us, but many of us feel very strongly one way or the other. We're going to do our dead level best to have this issue brought back before us on Friday once again. On Wednesday, it's my intention to just bring forward some of the commission appointees for the governor. And then at this point, I'm going to hold public testimony open, SJR 13. And with that, we're going to adjourn the meeting.